May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Peter Fisher. I'm an assistant Cook County State's Attorney on behalf of the respondent. Your Honors, we're here today because the petitioner in this habeas corpus case in a murder that took place in 1980 and a trial that took place in 1984 did not meet his burden of establishing prejudice to either overcome the procedural default or establish the merits of his due process claim. In this particular case, we have a ruling by the district court that had Myron Moses testified at petitioner's original trial back in 1984, that testimony would have, there was a reasonable probability that testimony would have resulted in a different verdict. And we assert that is completely erroneous and contrary to the facts in the case. In this particular case, you have, on the one hand, the testimony that came out about Myron Moses in the habeas corpus proceeding. That has to be balanced against the four eyewitnesses that testified in this case. As your honors will recall, there were two related incidents. In April 1st, 1980, the defendant, petitioner, went into a food and liquor store on the south side of Chicago, was in the store for a few minutes, was observed by Shirley Bowden, and she noticed him before any crime took place. She noticed him sort of hunching down with his collar up. She saw him. The room was well lit. She was only a few feet away. The defendant pulled out a gun, announced a stick-up. At this time, Bonnie Williams noticed the defendant. She also was only a few feet away. The defendant then shot the victim, in this case, George Vrabel, and ran out of the store. The incident lasted several minutes. The participants in that particular store had certainly adequate opportunity to observe, and as the Illinois Supreme Court found, that they made credible identifications of the defendant in that case. 4 days later, at a liquor store, at a bar, about a mile away, and interestingly enough, the defendant lived equidistant between the two crime scenes. The defendant again went into an establishment and this time pulled out a gun, announced a stick-up. There was a man named Thomas Fitzpatrick behind the bar. Mr. Fitzpatrick began to run away. The defendant shot him in the back. Fitzpatrick spun to the ground, laid on the ground. The defendant hovered over him with the gun. Again, this was well lit, only a few feet away. While this was happening, Roy Slagle, another person in the bar, took a chair and threw it at the defendant, saw the entire incident. The defendant was able to leave. Mr. Fitzpatrick lived. Interestingly enough, the bullet, which was taken from the body of the wounded victim, Thomas Fitzpatrick, was fired from the same gun as the bullet which as the gun which killed George Vrabel in this case. There was a positive match of the two bullets. 2 years later, the defendant himself was arrested. Lineups were held. The defendant eventually went to trial in 1984. All four of these witnesses testified at the defendant's trial, made positive, unimpeached, completely credible identifications of this defendant from circumstances that they would be able to recognize him as, the Illinois Supreme Court has found. In spite of that, the district court found that Myron Moses' testimony, given 20 years later, in front of the district court, was enough to overcome those four positive, credible identifications. There are several problems with this, of course. In terms of the clearly erroneous standard, the judge made several clearly erroneous comments. First of all, the judge said that Myron Moses had a better opportunity to observe the defendant than the people in the store. However, if you look at Myron Moses' testimony, it's clear that that's not true. Myron Moses was on the street, down the block, outside, at night, got at the most a few seconds to observe a man come out of the store. Myron Moses testified at trial that this took place at dusk, that there was sunlight out. Well, this was 10 o'clock at night in April. Clearly, couldn't have happened that way. Myron Moses said that he observed a man come out, run to a car, drive away. Very short incident. At night from a distance. In addition, had Myron Moses testified at the original trial, he would have been impeached with the fact that he had seen a lineup, There's no contest about that. He made a tentative identification. Detective Selecki would have said that this individual would have made a tentative identification of the defendant, Floyd Richardson. In addition, the district court heard testimony from Annette Butler, who was the girlfriend of Myron Moses, who was with Myron Moses on the street when this incident happened. Her rendition calls into great question whether Myron Moses is telling the truth. According to her, and more naturally, when the gunshots are fired, they run away from the store. They don't run to the store to get a better look. They run away. And Annette's saying they were running away, and at best they're turning around looking behind them to see whether or not they could see what was happening. Based on these factors, we assert that the trial court, the district court, made an improper calculation as to whether or not prejudice was present. We really have to determine what the jury would have had before them back in 1984. And on the one hand, we have four positive, credible identifications. And on the other hand, we have Myron Moses, who would have been impeached. Interestingly enough, and unlike many of the cases cited by the petitioner in this case, this isn't a case in which the testimony of Myron Moses directly impeaches anything that those four witnesses saw or said. This isn't a case where years later somebody came up and said, you know, I talked to the eyewitness and he said it didn't happen like this. It's a different story. It's not an impeaching story.
I got the impression that His Honor was more upset about the fact that what he found was the misleading by the prosecution of the defense at the original trial.
Well, I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think he was.
Could you explore that issue?
Well, first of all, we strenuously disagree that the state's attorney misled the defense at all in this case. We haven't raised it as an issue because, frankly, when you look at the district court's opinion, crafted over 14 months, it makes a lot of credibility and demeanor determinations that would have been extremely difficult to try and overturn at this point. But I will say that in order to find, as the district court did, you would have to accept a conspiracy theory that would make Oliver Stone blush. You have to assume that, well, first of all, the information relayed by the state's attorney is interesting because the person, Leonard Butler, who he says had the impeaching information about Myron Moses, that person actually existed. And not only did he actually exist, as we showed at the district court level, he existed at the place, not only work-wise, but home-wise, residence-wise, at the place that the state's attorney told the defense he would be found. So if you're going to make something up, it's hard to believe you would make something up that could be that easily disproved. All the defense had to do, and in fact, as you know, the case was recessed. The defense, once they found out about this statement, the defense said, geez, we've just heard about this. We know about Leonard Butler because he is Annette Butler's brother. But, you know, we didn't know about this statement. We just asked our client about it, and he says he didn't make, or I mean, we asked Myron Moses about it, and he says he didn't make these statements, but we haven't talked to Mr. Butler. And we'd like a recess until tomorrow. And Judge Maravich, the judge sitting in the state court at that time, said, sure, you can have recess till tomorrow. When the case reconvenes, the defense rests, and nothing's ever said about it again. The presumption, of course, under Strickland would have to be that they did go out and talk to these people, to this person. Unfortunately, neither of the public defenders in the case have any recollection. Again, not casting dispersions on them. It has been 20 years. It wasn't that big a deal at the time. There is no file. Frankly, there was no state file as well. One of the things that the trial court, well, the district court did is that
who advanced this theory that you scared them off falsely?
That came at the habeas proceeding.
Based on what information?
I think based on the petitioner's attorneys talking to Leonard Butler and Myron Moses years later.
Defense counsel weren't available, or at least didn't have any recollection of that. So it's based on Moses' testimony and Butler's testimony.
Yes, they said that they never talked to a state's, or Leonard Butler said he never talked to a state's attorney, Henry Lazaro, in this particular case. The interesting thing is that, of course, one of the reasons that the defense now asserts that there's been this, or that the district court found that there's been this nefarious action by the prosecution, was that the court puts in a footnote the fact that, well, the prosecution probably counted on the fact that the public defender was going to be lazy because the prosecutors and public defenders occupy the same courtrooms for a period of time, and they get to know each other, and they know their strengths and weaknesses. So he probably assumed that, geez, I'm going to make this up with a real person who really exists where he can be found, but I know they're not going to go look for him, so I'll be safe. Of course, that ignores the fact that there are two public defenders in this case. One was the courtroom public defender, and the other was a supervisor with which this prosecutor had not previously dealt in cases. Most significantly in this particular case, Your Honor, we do believe that the district court did allow his finding or his anger or his belief that there had been some misconduct by the prosecutor to color his result on the prejudice prong. And actually, there has to be two separate inquiries in a cause and prejudice case. And there's really a wall after you find cause. I mean, we are in no different position than we would have been had the trial judge simply said, I find that the defense counsel had been ineffective for calling this witness.
You're reading into your rebuttal time, I want you to.
I am. And I will reserve the minutes that I have for rebuttal, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fisher. We'll hear now from Mr. Sachs.
Thank you, Your Honor. Joshua Sachs for Appley Floyd Richardson, Your Honors. The first thing to point out about this case is the district court made a finding of fact after extensive evidentiary hearings that there had been a misrepresentation by the prosecution which resulted in the defense not calling a witness whose testimony was completely exculpatory and, if believed by the trial jury, would inevitably have resulted in the defendant's acquittal. The state has not challenged on appeal the district court's determination that such a misrepresentation was made. The state's brief is very clear that the issue which Mr. Fisher addressed for several minutes here today is simply not before this court. It was conceded. There is some language in the state's brief that indicates that the state's attorney doesn't agree privately, personally doesn't agree with Judge Canale's findings, but they haven't appealed it. It's not here. It hasn't been briefed. They haven't brought it to you because
it comes in almost inevitably, doesn't it, when we get to the prejudice part?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I say it would come in inevitably if we're considering the prejudice part. We have to consider the totality, don't we?
I think, Your Honor, that, the point is that...
Oh, no, no.
Try
it my way. In order to discuss the issue of prejudice, you have to take the entirety of the case. You can't simply pick out a section here or there that say that. When they say they're disputing his finding that the evidence itself would prejudice, you can't leave everything else out and just discuss that and say they've conceded the other part.
Well, Your Honor, what I'm saying is they've conceded the finding that there was a misrepresentation made at trial, and that's what resulted in the defense not calling Myron Moses to testify. That part has been conceded. Obviously, now...
I think they more or less said it was irrelevant.
Well...
which is not precisely a concession.
I don't have a problem with that, Your Honor. The issue before us now is... Take this exculpatory witness who was not permitted to testify before the jury. Are we prepared to say that the fact that a witness who would have said, I saw the crime, I saw the guy running away.
There's no finding that they were not allowed to call him. They didn't call him.
Your Honor, there's no finding that they were not allowed to call him. The finding was that a misrepresentation by the prosecutor caused the defense to withdraw him in the belief that there was going to be some devastating rebuttal.
Without talking to him.
We don't know whether he talked to him or not, Your Honor. The implication is that that they did not talk to him, that what they did, in fact, was they relied, as most as attorneys well might have, and as the Supreme Court in Banks versus Dratke said they could, they relied on what the prosecutor told them, the same way post-conviction counsel looked at the record.
But they didn't say that.
Pardon me?
They didn't say that.
Who didn't say that?
The defense attorneys did not say they relied on what the prosecutor told them.
No, they didn't, Your Honor. I think they couldn't. They couldn't remember. That was the district court's determination after.
Getting to the predicate for his determination, and it's based on they didn't remember. And
no,
therefore,
Your Honor,
it must have happened.
No, Your Honor, it was based on the record that clearly shows that counsel was going to call him,
yes.
And the prosecutor made this representation.
And then he asked for a recess.
And then it was based on the undisputed testimony of Floyd Richardson, who said that his defense attorney came to him and explained to him the problem with Mr. Butler coming in rebuttal, and that the attorney said, we'd better not put Moses on the stand. And Richardson agreed with his attorney's analysis. That was the evidence, and that's not contradicted at all. The only question here is whether defendant is prejudiced within the meaning of Kyles versus Whiteley, Bailey versus United States, Brady versus Maryland, Strickler versus Green, cases which clearly say it's not necessary for the defendant to establish that the testimony that was improperly suppressed would certainly or even would probably have led to a different result. The question is there a reasonable probability, meaning a reasonable possibility, a significant possibility, it doesn't have to be more likely than not, that the result of the trial could have been different. Now, we have, as Mr. Fisher pointed out, four eyewitnesses, two from the incident charge, two from an unrelated incident, which was possibly connected by ballistics evidence, by which I mean it was clear there was evidence that the same gun was used. Mm. It was an inference that the prosecutor asked the jury to draw that the gun was in the same hands on both occasions. There's no physical corroboration. There are no admissions by the defendant. And we have another eyewitness who says, no, I know Floyd Richardson, and the man I saw running out of the store is not Floyd Richardson. Now, just what is it that the state says is so incredible about Myron Moses? Are they denying that he was there? Well, they're not denying that he was there. He was clearly there. Are they denying that he saw the man run out of the store? No. Are they denying that he got a look at him, that he got a good look at him? They seem to be denying that, and yet we know that Mr. Moses assisted the police in preparing a composite sketch of the robber whom he saw, that Mr. Fitzpatrick, one of the men from the tavern robbery, one of the witnesses in the tavern robbery, looked at that sketch prepared by the police with the assistance of Myron Moses and says, that fits the man to a T. That was the testimony at trial. So to say that Myron Moses didn't see anything, didn't have an opportunity to view anything, that is, with all respect, not true. What we have here is a case in which you have prosecution witnesses who claim they saw the robber. That man whom we see for the first time 2 years after the crime, that's him. And we have Myron Moses, who says, I know who Floyd Richardson is, and the man I saw run out of the store was not Floyd Richardson. And that, Your Honors, is a classic, classic jury question. Now, Judge Kennelly did not say, absolutely did not say, Myron Moses is credible, the trial witnesses are not. He didn't make any such finding. What he said was the trial witnesses, at least uncontradicted as they were at trial, gave powerful testimony, I think was his words. Myron Moses gave powerful testimony. A jury should have heard that question. To come in now and ask that this court affirmed the a holding of a state trial jury that heard only the witnesses for the prosecution and not the exculpatory testimony of an eyewitness for the defense, whose integrity has never been challenged and whose credibility, his opportunity to view, is subject to as much support as it is challenge, is one of the strangest arguments, frankly, that I've ever heard in a court of review. He's asking this court to sit in the place of an Illinois state court jury. What Judge Cannelli said was, send this case back to a state court jury to hear this case tried, to hear the evidence for both sides. Now, what was this case? What was the defense at trial? What kind of a defense at trial did Richardson put on? There was he brought up the question about photo identifications. Not a standing alone. Not really the strongest defense to make. It's what he had. He argued about a beard. Was a beard full or was it scraggly? And the prosecutor, as you recall from the briefs, sort of made fun of that argument at trial. He said, you've heard all these witnesses. What does Mr. Richardson offer? He couldn't grow a beard. And they pointed out that the identifications took place a couple of years after. It is counsel were doing the best they could with what they had, and it was that kind of a defense. You don't have a lot to work with. You put on what you've got. It's a completely different case if they come in with a witness who Judge Cannelli, after having heard him testify, found to be extremely credible based on his demeanor, based on the corroboration from what happened. And you can disagree with that determination, and Judge Cannelli didn't mean it to be final. What he meant was this man is credible enough that a jury should have heard him. And it's a very, very different case. If the defense had called Myron Moses and he'd said, well, I know who Floyd Richardson is. Did you see this man running out of the store? Yes, I did. Did you help the police with a picture? Yes, I did. Is this the picture? Yeah, that's the picture. You were close enough to describe this man? Yes, I was. Well, was it Floyd Richardson? Oh, absolutely not. You know who it was? No, I don't. But I know this. It wasn't Floyd Richardson. It was nobody I'd ever seen before, which is what he testified to at habeas. The man came 20 years later to testify in a federal court about a case he knew nothing about. To which he had no connection. He owed Floyd Richardson nothing. He had no reason to come up from Georgia and stick his neck out to commit perjury for a murderer. That's ridiculous. He was an honorable man. He's a businessman. He's 40 years old. He's a prominent man down in Atlanta. And 20 years later, he was sticking to this story. And, yes, the jury would not have heard 40-year-old Myron Moses from Atlanta, the automobile merchant. They would have heard a young fellow who was working in an optometrist shop for his father, but they would have heard a straight, hard-working kid say, I don't know, I have no interest in this case. I don't know Floyd Richardson. Maybe he would have said, I don't even like Floyd Richardson. But the man that ran out of that store, that wasn't Floyd Richardson. Well, maybe the jury would have believed him, maybe not. I don't know. State's attorney doesn't know. Judge Cannelli didn't know, and he didn't pretend to know. What he did say is, it's not the same trial. It fundamentally changes the case. In the light of the United States Supreme Court against Kyles versus Whiteley, what this does is, the suppressed favorable evidence could reasonably be taken to put the whole case in such a different light as to undermine confidence in the verdict. Now, to say that a case in which identifications are uncontradicted, everybody agrees that's the guy, which is what the prosecutor argued at trial. Everybody agrees that that's the guy. There is a completely different case from a case in which the evidence is, these people say that's the guy. This guy says, no way, I know him, and that wasn't him. If that doesn't put the case in a completely different light, what the Supreme Court says in Kyle's has just no meaning. Now,
counsel, if this matter is sent back to the state court, is your client subject to the death penalty?
Well, double jeopardy doesn't prevent it, Your Honor. It's a matter of state law, in my opinion. I think what it comes down to is this. If the governor who commuted his sentence, if the governor commuted his sentence for the conviction, then he is subject to the death penalty. If the governor commuted his sentence for the crime, then he's not subject to the death penalty.
What's the difference between the conviction and the crime?
Your Honor, I'm just talking about how the Illinois Supreme Court might, in my opinion, analyze what is the meaning of a commutation under Illinois law. The question is he subject to the death penalty if he goes back to trial? The answer is maybe he is. I don't think anybody could. I think anybody who told Mr. Richardson for sure you are or are not subject to a death penalty when you go back would be misleading him. And all we could tell, if you want to know what we told him you'd better expect the possibility that you would be eligible if you go back because nobody can tell you you're not.
Hmm.
Just a word about Annette Butler. She was not called by anybody at trial. She was called by the defense, by Mr. Richardson, at the habeas corpus hearing because she disputed something very important in a police report, which Mr. Fisher has referred to. He said that if Moses had testified at trial, he would have been impeached by a police report that he made a tentative identification of Floyd Richardson. What the police report said was, Myron Moses made a tentative identification, Pearl Cox made a tentative identification, Annette Butler made a tentative identification. At habeas corpus, Myron Moses said, never happened. Annette Butler, we called to say, never happened. And what she said was, I didn't even see the guy, couldn't have made an identification. On cross-examination, she testified about other things. The court found her not credible. Pearl Cox, who was standing right next
to... Mr. Sachs, I'll have to ask you to wind up now.
Of course, Your Honor. As I say, everybody who testified about that police report said it was false. Your Honors, I think I've made my point. I think the briefs are pretty clear. If the court has any questions, I'll be happy to answer them as best I can. If not... Judge Kennelly was right, and we ask the court to affirm the decision below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sachs. You have 3 minutes, Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try and move quickly if I can. First of all, Illinois' pardon and commutation provisions are different than the federal, than the president's. There has to actually be a, you can't prospectively pardon somebody for a crime. It has to be for a conviction. On the police report as to whether there's a tentative identification made by anyone in this case, the district court, placed great emphasis on his belief that Pearl Cox had rebutted that and Myron Moses had rebutted that. In fact, in his ruling, the district court said that Pearl Cox said categorically she did not make a tentative identification. That's absolutely not true. In fact, I asked her at the hearing, when you saw this lineup, do you recall whether or not you said anything along the lines of he looks similar or it looks like the guy or anything like that? I possibly could have said, could have been. So she didn't categorically deny making a tentative identification at all. reasonable probability is not the same as reasonable possibility, as counsel suggests. The standard is reasonable probability. And the bottom line is we have to go back to what the jury would have had back in 1984. Four identifications on the one hand, completely unimpeached, credible, found to be credible by the Supreme Court. One severely impeached set of identifications or identification by Myron Moses. So basically the jury would have had to decide, is somebody lying or is somebody mistaken? Those are really the only two issues. And we know these people weren't lying. That issue's already been been settled. They weren't lying. They were found to be credible witnesses. There was no suggestion as to those identifications. So their identifications are credible and reliable. Nothing Myron Moses said in 1984, would have said in 1984, and did say in 2004, could change those identifications. So, in essence, the jury would have had to believe a quadruple coincidence buttressed by the matching ballistics versus this man who was impeached. Not only was he impeached with the things I've mentioned, but he looked at this lineup. He admits he saw the lineup, and he saw this person that he knows, Floyd Richardson, in the lineup, and never says to anyone, including Annette Butler afterwards, that, you know, I saw this lineup and my friend was in the lineup. This is a person who knew the defendant, supposedly, who went to school with the defendant's brothers. You know, it's interesting. It's literally a balance here. They say that the Myron Moses identification is more credible because he knew the defendant. Well, they also say that there's nothing in this case to impeach the that there's no bias on the part of Myron Moses. Well, the more you know someone, the more the bias. The less you know, the less bias. You can't have it both ways. You can't both say he was an unbiased witness and say that he had an adequate, you know, that he knew the person. For all those reasons and the reasons expressed in the briefs, Your Honors, we'd ask that you reverse the finding of the district court. Thank you,
Mr. Fisher. Our thanks to both counsel in this case, and the case will now be taken under advisement.